back together again, you and I, on a Tuesday, the 17th of January, 2023, on Connecticut Today. We featured some riveting first-person accounts of life-saving actions taken at a recent college hockey game in Bridgeport. Journal Inquirer of Manchester columnist Chris Powell weighed in on Connecticut's high electric rates and the start of recreational marijuana sales during his monthly check-in. Former Bridgeport mayoral candidate and state legislator Chris Caruso chimed in on the state of the Park City's mayoral race. So just a couple of days after the nation witnessed what happened with Damar Hamlin during that Monday night football game, there was also almost a tragedy in Bridgeport at the Total Mortgage Arena in a college hockey game, a men's game between Sacred Heart and Army, an Atlantic Hockey Association game. And earlier today, I was able to take part in a Zoom call with the principals involved there, talking about the quick reactions of the trainer, the player, and the staff in Bridgeport, just seconds away, and the staff here at St. Vincent's Medical Center trauma team, who sprung into action and saved the life of Eric Huss. He's a West Point junior from Dallas, Texas, plays hockey for the Army Black Knights. So let's go to what Eric had to say in part, and he talks about the injury that he incurred during that game.
I think it was a little bit into the second period. I remember just back-checking on one of the Sacred Heart players, and my line mate Noah Wilson, he stepped up to hit the player, and when he hit him, his foot just came up, and it felt like I had been hit in the face, like with a punch. I didn't even register that I got cut or anything, but it felt like I almost felt like a little concussed, kind of just in like shock. And so I immediately started going to the bench, because I mean, my helmet fell off at that point. Like, first thing you do, go to the bench. So I'm going to the bench, kind of holding my face, because I'm looking down and I see just all this blood kind of just trailing. And so as a hockey player, our first thought is, oh, we lost teeth. And so I immediately put my hand on my mouth. And as I got to the bench, I stopped and it just continued to bleed. I was bleeding all over the ice. And at this point, I was like, well, it's not coming from my mouth. I don't know what's going on. And then as soon as I was at the bench, Rachel was already there. She already had a towel in her hand, and I immediately felt her put her hand on my face where the cut was. And at that point, like, kind of the bleeding stopped from my end, at least is what I could see. And she was like, hey, we need to get off the ice right now. Went to the kind of the corner where EMT was. Went through there, they cut off all my gear, and then Rachel was with me the whole time. She didn't take her hands off my face. I mean, her hands were like in the cut. She's asking me how I was doing. I was like, well, it's like uncomfortable, but I feel fine. And I didn't really understand the extent of my injury. I remember just joking around with her a bunch on the ride over and everything. And obviously I got to St. Vincent's, and then I was kind of more apparent of the extent of my injury. My first thought was just, man, that was a lot of blood, was kind of my whole thought process throughout this thing. I'd have to give credit to my dad, though. He's a surgeon. So his big thing is being polite and respectful and listening during any traumatic events or when you need to be in surgery. So that was running through my head a bunch. And then my second thought was like, I hope the guys are okay, honestly, because I was right by the bench. And I know a few of the boys kind of saw the cut firsthand, like right there. So those were my two big thoughts, honestly.
And we continue with outlining what happened on the 5th of January, the Total Mortgage Arena in downtown Bridgeport, just a couple of days after the national drama surrounding Damar Hamlin of the Buffalo Bills that played out on national television. We had a situation that could have been tragic in Bridgeport, Army taking on Sacred Heart in a men's hockey game there. Eric Huss, a West Point junior from Dallas, catching a skate blade inadvertently in the lower jaw and the neck. I spoke to one of the trainers a few days ago who actually treated him. The cut went from the tip of the jaw all the way back under one of his ears. So think about that, on the right side of his face. So how does a trainer react to this, an athletic trainer? We see them all the time on television. Rachel Leahy participated in the Zoom call today. Rachel is a West Point senior associate trainer for men's hockey. She also, by the way, is a 2016 Quinnipiac University graduate with a Bachelor's of Science degree in athletic training. So how did Rachel Leahy, the Army trainer, spring into action when she saw what had happened on the ice?
I saw the hit at center ice, and actually it wasn't Eric that I was watching. I was watching the player that had made the hit, just making sure that he got up okay. And then I kind of looked a little bit to my left and I saw the trail of blood on the ice. And I was like, oh gosh. And then I heard a little bit of commotion and I saw Eric, you know, kind of skate towards the bench. So then I just put one foot up on the board and hopped 2 feet over. And then once I got over the boards, I just looked at him and he was kind of like picking his head up towards me. And that's when I saw like how much bleeding was occurring. And I got like a good frontal view of him. So that I just ran over. I got two hands kind of on his wound, on his face. And I was like, okay, we're going this way. And we just immediately started getting off the ice towards EMS. And the Sacred Heart athletic trainer, Ben St. Martin, was right behind me. And so the two of us, we got off the ice, you know, EMS was starting to meet us over there. We got him seated on a gurney. We got him in a comfortable position where I could, you know, apply good pressure, but wasn't hurting him. And then, you know, it just kind of worked as a team there. You know, it got kind of, it's like a blur in my mind because it's hard to pick out, you know, what we did in what order. But, you know, Ben St. Martin started cutting off his jersey in case, you know, we needed to get all his equipment off. We got skate guards on his skate. We were taking vitals and then we were transporting. We were moving towards the door. And, you know, as we got closer to the ambulance, we realized that there wasn't any space for me to stand next to him. So I was like, I need to get on top of him. And so somebody actually hoisted me up and placed my legs on top of him, so that I can continue to apply pressure, and still fit in the ambulance. And then from there, I think it was a couple minutes, we were down the street, or we rolled right into the emergency department with me sitting on top of him. And then at that point I was able to transfer care, to the emergency department and all the doctors and nurses. I've never dealt with severe bleeding to this extent, but I've been involved in a couple emergency situations where we had to enact emergency action plan and call EMS and kind of go through a similar situation, but not with bleeding to this extent. I think initially I was shocked because this is my second year as a full-time ice hockey athletic trainer, and I recognized how severe the injury was. And, you know, many athletic trainers go their entire career without ever seeing this. So I was kind of like, oh my goodness, this is what I'm approaching. But then after that, it was go time. You know, I was just going through my steps, making sure that, you know, we had accurate vital signs on him and that he was conscious and that he was comfortable, and just making sure that he was continuing to talk to us and, you know, keeping him calm and making sure that, you know, we were following our steps that we needed to. And then, you know, from there, I remember looking around and making sure that the rest of the guys were okay. And I told coach, hey, I'm going to need to go with him. Is there somebody that is going to cover? And, you know, Ben St. Martin, the Sacred Heart athletic trainer, stepped up, was like, don't even worry about it, I'll cover the team. So yeah, I was just making sure that our guy was okay.
So the accident happens, the athletic trainer there helps get Eric Huss to St. Vincent's, Rachel Leahy there. And then when they get there, the St. Vincent trauma surgeon on duty was Dr. Matthew Carlson, and he talked about picking it up from there.
Eric came through as a level one trauma activation. We didn't really know much more information than that. So, you know, we're ready for anything that can come through the door, and that's essentially what happened. I think Sacred Heart is very close. So we didn't get much advanced notice until they arrived, basically. What was happening, we saw Rachel holding pressure on the stretcher, like she mentioned. You could see that Eric was injured badly, was very pale, but he was also very calm and alert, which was a good sign. The paramedic that was there was able to tell us that, given his view of the injury, he thought the carotid artery was probably okay, which would sort of fit the picture of how he was looking when he arrived. we saw a very brief glimpse of the wound and decided that this was something that needed to be handled in the operating room. So we quickly made preparations to get blood ready for transfusion. Our anesthesiologist came down to the emergency department and did a great job of getting things expedited so that we could move quickly to the operating room. Got him up in the operating room with one of our physician's assistants taking over from Rachel, holding pressure on the wound. Got him up. They got him off to sleep very quickly. Prepped the wound while we were still holding pressure. The operating room team did a great job getting the instruments and everything set up quickly. And we were able to explore the wound pretty rapidly from the time that he arrived in the operating room. He ended up getting a few blood transfusions during the operation. The operation itself was starting and just looking at what the extent of the injury was, because again, we didn't really have a great idea, in the emergency department. But you could see that his facial artery on the right side was severed. So there was two basic ends that were bleeding rapidly. There was some injury to the muscle of the neck, but the primary life-threatening injury that he had was an injury to his facial artery, which we were able to clamp and sort of ligate both ends of that. And he did great. Other than that, it was just, closing a big cut that he had on his face and neck. He woke up in the operating room. He probably doesn't know this, but he was asking where Rachel was. He obviously understood that, what a great job that she did for him and all the other people, at the arena and EMS. Everything just worked perfectly. So we were very happy and he did great.
From your perspective, how important and how vital were Rachel's efforts in all of this?
It single-handedly got him to the hospital in as good a shape as he was. Saved his life, I think, in no uncertain terms. Well, I think his jawbone really, kind of saved his life. I think it bore the brunt of the impact from the skate. I think had it not been for that, I think it would have injured his face, and certainly his carotid artery would have been severed, I think. It's lucky that the angle that he was struck at, it's lucky that his bone was there to sort of take the impact. But I think in terms of location, this was something that could have turned out very differently had it not been for that. Everybody along the way did exactly what we'd like for them to do, from the injury time itself to the transport, which was very quick. The anesthesiologist, again, the operating room team, my team, in terms of holding pressure on the injury while we got him to the operating room. It's, I think, the sequence of steps. Everybody did what they should do to give him the best possible outcome, and I think limit the amount of blood that he lost. I think just speaks to how quickly he was able to recuperate enough to get home in a timely fashion.
And a life saved in Bridgeport. Let's go to one of our regular contributors here on All Things Connecticut, Chris Powell, former managing editor and current columnist still at the Journal Inquirer of Manchester. Make sure you check out Chris's columns, insightful as they always are. Chris, good afternoon, sir. How are you?
Hey, Paul. Great to be with you.
Chris, can you verify before we go on with this that you do not have any classified documents in your garage? Can you have you checked all your boxes there, Chris?
Oh, God knows what we've got here. We've got family possessions on three floors from relatives all over the country, and God knows what we have. But if you want any of it, stop by.
Okay, but no documents on Russian troop movements or anything like that.
No, or nothing on the president's business dealings with China.
One of your latest columns, Chris, I read it smiling because you took the words right out of my mouth. This lunacy when it comes to electric rates in the state, and the fact that, we come up with these Band-Aids where we're going to increase the funding for this and we're going to have this program and that program. Chris, we never just get to the bottom of the issue, do we? The electricity is so damn expensive, right?
Well, the real issue, as far as I can see, Paul, it's a simple matter of supply and demand. If you want prices to go down, you can either increase supply or you can reduce demand. But all we seem to do in Connecticut is try to shift costs around so that people, you know, don't know exactly who's paying for what and why. I don't think our legislators really want electric rates to go down, because if they did, probably the first thing they would do is remove the social environmental costs that have been stuffed into electric bills that people don't understand. The electric companies are very reluctant to talk about this because they know they'll just aggravate the legislators who are, you know, hiding these state government costs and electric bills. But I did once get Eversource to acknowledge that 15 to 20% of our electric bills are actually not for electricity at all. They're for various social programs and environmental programs that state government is hiding in electric bills. So you could cut 20% or as much as 20% of our electric bills almost instantly, simply by transferring those costs out of electric bills and into the state budget.
And on top of that, Chris, you know, you and I look at our electric bills, and I urge people to do this. You know, people think cable television bills or cell phone bills are impossible to read. I mean, and you and I have followed this for years. It's not so much the actual cost of generating the power, Chris, although that is up there sometimes. It's all these other costs, like you said, and these transmission costs too, that make your head spin.
Yeah, well, you know, we're going to pay something to maintain the lines in front of our houses, but you know, I've got solar panels on my roof here, and my monthly bill to Eversource is only something like $9.62.
Wow.
I mean, I pay something, usually more than $100, to the solar power company whose equipment that we use, but the power company's own costs are pretty easy to evade. The power company is just forwarding to us the cost of its own purchase of electricity from generators. We can, if we want to take the little extra effort, we can go to the Public Utilities Regulatory Authority internet site and get the list of generating companies that are selling power in Connecticut. We can go through that list and find a generator that is charging less than the so-called standard offer that we buy through the utility companies. But people are too lazy to do this. We've had this system for more than 20 years. You want cheaper power? Shop for it.
You talked about Pura. Well-intentioned, I guess. Do they have any real power here, Chris, or not?
Well, yeah, they have power, but we have set the Utility Regulatory Authority up to be a little divorced from politics, because you don't really want politics setting electric rates. When politics is setting electric rates, you know what's going to happen. There's going to be all sorts of political deals made and cost shifting done, and eventually the power companies will be expropriated by state government, which will make them deliver their services below cost. So we have the regulatory agency whose mission is both to get electricity out to the public at a, you know, economical efficient way, and to make sure that the utility companies are financially strong enough to stay in business and to sustain the power grid. That's the dual mandate of the Utilities Commission. We could get power much cheaper in Connecticut. And by the way, there was a study the other day said we have the highest electric costs in the continental United mm-hmm. States. But we could get power much cheaper if we would get the federal government to force Maine and New Hampshire to let Hydro-Quebec run power lines down from Quebec and their hydro power. Hydro-Quebec is full of cheap and clean power that we could get if Maine and New Hampshire were not obstructing the construction of the high capacity power lines. We don't do that. We could get much cheaper power if New York would agree to let more natural gas supply lines, pipelines, be run across New York State, but they won't. And what does our congressional delegation do about this? Do they seek federal intervention to make sure that we can increase supply of conventional and environmentally sound fuel in Connecticut? No, they don't do a damn thing. So, you know, they're just, you know, shifting costs around. They're requiring subsidies to be given to poor people at the expense of middle-class people. Middle-class people are going to pay higher rates so that the poor people, poor customers of the utility companies will get more subsidies. The state's going to kick in a very small amount of its surplus to subsidize rates. But is anybody in our Democratic regime here in Connecticut clamoring for the National Democratic Administration to stop pledging to destroy the conventional fuels industry so we can get, you know, more oil, more gas into Connecticut? No. There's things that could be done, but you've got to increase supply. And our regime in Connecticut is not really very interested in increasing supply.
Chris Powell with us. A couple of more minutes. Our monthly check-in, former managing editor, current editorialist still, opinion leader at the Journal Inquirer Manchester. Chris, your thoughts on now, at least at the medicinal outlets, with the retail outlets still to come, the beginning of recreational marijuana sales in Connecticut. Now, I will tell you, Chris, I do not have any THC gummies with me. Although on some days my producer says I should try it, but other than that, what do you think?
Well, I don't think I should go on the radio after consuming any THC gummies. But I saw last week that you know, the state government and the news organizations announced that marijuana is legal in Connecticut, and it's completely false. Marijuana is not legal in Connecticut. It remains a federal misdemeanor to be in possession of marijuana in Connecticut. It remains a federal felony to sell marijuana in Connecticut. Every store that is out there now selling marijuana in the open is committing a federal felony with every sale. Now, why is this not being prosecuted? It's not being prosecuted because our, you know, recent administrations, both Democratic and Republican, have decided that when the Constitution says the president shall take care that the, you know, the laws would be you know, faithfully executed, the Constitution doesn't mean what it says, and you can ignore it anytime you want. You know, that's really not how things should operate. The current Attorney General Merrick Garland has told Congress, reading his testimony here, "I do not think it the best use of the Justice Department's limited resources to pursue prosecutions of those who are complying with the laws in states that have legalized and are effectively regulating marijuana." End quote. This is so misleading. Garland, the Attorney General, is saying, "Oh, you know, we just don't have the money to enforce the federal law on marijuana." It wouldn't take any money at all. The federal government, the FBI, would need only to go into one marijuana store in Connecticut or any state and make an arrest. The business everywhere would fold up in a matter of hours. The business has blossomed only in the confidence that the federal government will not follow the Constitution, will not enforce the law. Now, look, I don't think marijuana should be criminalized, but it is criminalized. Federal law says that it's a federal felony to sell it, and our government has just decided, no, we don't have to enforce the laws that we don't like. Well, that's totalitarianism. So, yeah. If we have certain rights and liberties that are guaranteed by law, and the federal government decides it doesn't want to enforce the law to protect them, that's okay. Look, the thing to do here is to repeal the federal law criminalizing marijuana, or at least get the drug reclassified to a lesser penalty. But It's a federal felony to sell marijuana in Connecticut. And the Justice Department knows where this is happening, and the Justice Department has just decided that, you know, we're not going to take care of the law is faithfully executed in Connecticut. This is nullification of federal law by the state of Connecticut, just like the state of Connecticut is nullifying federal immigration law by encouraging illegal immigration and giving identification documents to illegal immigrants and interfering with the enforcement of immigration law by federal agents. This is nullification of federal law. It's nullification in the of federal drug law as well. And, you know, this used to be a treasonous. I mean, that's what the Civil War was about. It was about nullification. But now we do it whenever we don't like a particular federal policy.
Chris, finally, the thing that made me laugh all the way through the legalization process, and I talked about this the other day, you know, juxtapose that with what the reaction would have been, Chris Powell, if some group or legislators got up there or some interest group said, you know what, we need more vaping in the state, you know, and I know you can vape cannabis, but no, we need more vaping in the state. And I think that we should have more relaxed tobacco laws in the state. You would quite rightfully, I think, see everybody from every lung and heart and pulmonary association up there. But, you know, sans the opposition to marijuana, which there was from the state medical association, some of those same people, Chris Powell, whose heads would explode if we expanded tobacco, they were, most of them, awfully quiet during this whole thing.
Yeah, that's a hell of a good point, Paul. I mean, look, you don't have to think marijuana should be criminal to realize it's not a good thing. It is addictive. It has some medical properties, but it is addictive. It can mess people up pretty badly. Yeah, where were all these medical people? You know, very few of them were around when the state decided to get into the marijuana business. But look, it's happening again. You may have seen that a legislator has introduced a bill in the legislature to let certain bars stay open serving patrons till 4 in the morning.
That's a great idea. Chris, isn't that a great idea?
Yeah, so, you know, like, we don't have enough wrong-way crashes in Connecticut now in the middle of the night. But, you know, this is a payoff to the two Indian casinos, and they're going to throw in some bars in some of the cities. Drinking until 4 a.m. and then driving home, are you guys nuts? Well, no, it's just it's a payoff to the Indian casinos, and nobody cares how many more people are going to die because of it. I would go along with the 4 a.m. closing time if the law required that the doors on the bars be locked from the outside at, you know, 2 in the morning and not unlocked again until noon, so that, you know, everybody drinking at 4 in the morning would, you know, have to stay inside until noontime. This is totally nuts, but you're right. It fits right in with, you know, the encouragement of marijuana smoking.
Chris, thank you as always. Chris Powell, good to hear from you. We'll check back with you in a bit. Thank you, sir.
Thank you, Paul. Bye-bye.
Appreciate it. Chris Powell there. The Bridgeport mayoral race has another official entrant, although it was everybody amused, although I ran into Marilyn Moore a couple of weeks ago at a local function, and I asked her if she had any news for me, and she kind of tiptoed around her answer, so I kind of knew there. That's what was going on. Brian Lockhart's story in the Connecticut Post. And folks, what do you think of this? Any early thoughts on Bridgeport's mayor's race? If you're in the city, if you're a city resident, even if you're not, you know, as the cities in the state go, so goes the state, whether it's Greater Bridgeport, Hartford, New Haven, New London, Waterbury, Danbury, Meriden, Middletown. Marilyn Moore on Tuesday, today filing paperwork with the town clerk's office to run for mayor again against incumbent Joe Ganim. So we'll see what shakes out this time. Now, of course, Marilyn Moore losing to Joe Ganim after a primary fight a couple of years ago. And remember that night? Boy, what an interesting turnabout we had that night when Marilyn Moore won at the polls but lost the you know, absentee ballot thing, and there were accusations flying left and right. So how will that pay off? Now, remember, it's a four-person race now. John Gomes, as Brian points out here in early December, launched his own campaign, and he has raised, at last look, a little over $100,000. So Marilyn Moore just entering the race again. John Gomes raising $100,000. And also a fourth candidate, Lamond Daniels, former aide who worked for Joe Ganim to help beat Bill Finch. He has raised, what's it say here, about $27,000. So there you go, a four-way race in Bridgeport. Is there any DraftKings action on this, huh? DraftKings, FanDuel. See, I'm telling you, I want to do this. I think this is a great idea. The sports books here in Connecticut should do what these offshore books do. I get emails from a couple of British and UK-based books. They bet on anything. They bet on sports. They bet on politics. So what's the money line now on Joe Ganim? I mean, if he's a favorite, you'd have to say, what, he's minus 200? Maybe Marilyn Moore is the top challenger. You know, the challengers are always plus. You bet $100, you win something over that. Well, would Marilyn Moore be here? I don't know, maybe plus 225 or something like that? I don't know. Imagine me setting lines on Bridgeport politics. Oh, my God. And you know who could be my color commentator on all this? Chris Caruso. There you go.
Hey, Paul, how you doing?
Chris, I love it. The more the merrier. I like political chaos, Chris, and the more the merrier. There you go.
Well, you'll get it in a four-way race, that's for sure.
Listen, Chris, there's not enough multiple voices. I think the people deserve that. Yeah. So let's spend the next 10 or so months hearing from all four candidates.
Yeah, you know, it doesn't hurt the city of Bridgeport, that's for sure, because you'll get a lot of different ideas and approaches and policies. Traditional thinking is, though, that the incumbent usually does well in a four-way race because he has a base of votes and the opponents are working on the anti-Ganim vote. So that anti-Ganim vote is just so large and it's not enough to win a race by themselves. So, you know, they'll work against Ganim. Ganim will get his base of votes out and then the anti-vote will be split up between the other three candidates. You know, back in 1985, when I was campaign manager for Tom Busey, we had a four-way race going on. But believe it or not, in those days, 23 to 25,000 people would come out and vote in a primary.
Wow.
And we won that primary by 1,500 votes. Today, you're lucky if you get 8,000 people to come out in a primary. So the margin and the numbers are so much smaller, it favors the incumbent in this case. So, you know, the only way that Maryland could win or one of the other two is a message that resonates and breaks her or whomever those opponents out of the pack. So that way it's just a race between, you know, Maryland and the mayor. See, back in 2019, it was a head-to-head race, Joe Ganim against Marilyn Moore.
Sure.
So that's why it was so much closer. But when you do a four-way race, it's going to be interesting, but traditional thinking is, and based on past, you know, voting patterns and practices, is the incumbent usually is favored in those types of races.
Could you see, Chris, a scenario where, yes, the mayor has enough support to win the primary, but then whomever finishes second is able to cull the support of everybody else, like you say, and then go with a write-in candidacy or a third-party run? You think that's what may shake out here?
You know, I have never seen a write-in campaign win, with the exception of Jorjura from Waterbury.
Yeah, yeah.
You know, he and I were colleagues together in the legislature, and he ran for mayor, and lost the primary, but then did a write-in campaign and actually won that. And that was one of the few times that write-in candidacy's worked. You know, he was very popular in this town. He owned a store where they sold fruits. It was a fruit wholesaler. And so people knew him. And then he made up pencils and gave pencils out to everyone. So the whole campaign, you know, he was a mayor, you know, he'd lost in the primary. So he had the name recognition. I think, you know, when you look at any situation that could happen, it is a Democratic city. So the favor is toward the Democrat. In an election, if a person went independent, then they pick up Democrat, Republican, and independent across the board. Yeah. That would make it interesting. But, you know, it always favors, again, you know, the voter role in Bridgeport is, as in any city, is predominantly Democratic. But, you know, anything is possible at this point. You know, the other thing is how well that person does in the primary, the number two slot. How well do they do? That propels them into the general election or not. And, you know, that's yet again to be seen, you know.
Finally, Chris, the mayor apparently has, according to documents, about $235,000 on hand, according to reports. In your mind, is that a hefty amount of money for this stage?
Oh, of course it is. And, you know, what the point of raising a lot of money is to scare off opponents. That's the thought behind it, because your opponent can never amass as much as the incumbent can. So, you know, he's off to a good start. But keep in mind, if you look at Ganim's races over the years, $235,000 is small. Now, I'm sure he'll gain more in some years. He's actually at $600,000 in the bank. But, you know, a primary in Bridgeport, based on what I know and my involvement, you could win against an incumbent with $150,000. But again, it's better if you have a face-to-face match with the incumbent. When you start splitting it out, there's only so many voters you can reach that want to be against the incumbent. The rest is usually in favor of the incumbent. So this is totally different than 2019. Maryland, you know, has name recognition, no question, because of, you know, her state Senate seat, and she's run before. So she has definitely name recognition. But with the other two candidates, and it's going to pull votes from her. So that's yet to be seen. And will she be able to have a message that resonates? You know, all three candidates are going to be talking against Ganim and an anti-Ganim. So how is her platform going to be different than the other two? You know, what's going to distinguish her as a candidate that could beat, you know, possibly Ganim? And that's a hard task, you know. So can it be done? Of course, anything is possible. But just traditionally looking at votes and the number of people that come out in an election, and is there going to be excitement? You know, in a four-way race, there may not be a lot of excitement. People will say, well, you know, Ganim's going to win, so why even come out and vote? And that's what often happens in these situations, you know.
And the other thing, Chris, is whether it's a municipal race or a state-level race, you know, the municipal or the state unions, you know, that's very powerful. Chris, you and I both know this, and I always tell people, you know, whether the union is for an incumbent or against an incumbent, it's not just that union vote. It usually carries down through the family. So it's the union vote plus the spouse and or the domestic partner and any kids as well.
Oh, absolutely. You know, in 2007, Paul, when I ran for mayor in the Democratic primary, this is my second attempt at running, I had 19 unions endorsing me, far more than my opponent, 19 unions, and many of them were the municipal unions. And even with all of that effort, I lost, I think, by 270 votes in the Democratic primary. And in 2003, I also had many of the unions with me as well. You're right. You know, the unions will bring, you know, in addition to the votes, they bring people power, you know, people that will go door to door for you, knock on votes, making phone calls. It's invaluable to have the support of union. But understand, you've got an incumbent that's going to have union support as well. You know, it's when you look at politics and you look at especially municipal races, you look at it as a pie. And there's so much of the pie that's going to be baked for the incumbent. Let's say half of the pie is for the incumbent. The other half has to be split now among three opponents. So it just becomes more challenging. Just look at it statistically. It becomes more challenging to beat the incumbent. I'm not saying it's impossible, and who knows? A bolt of lightning may strike here in Bridgeport, but it just shows that it's a bigger challenge to do it, you know?
Chris, thank you. Great insight there. Chris, take care. Chris Caruso, former Democratic state rep, mayoral candidate. So this is going to be interesting. Joe Gannon, Marilyn Moore, John Gomes, and Lamont Daniels. There you go. Four candidates. The more voices, the merrier. Let them all duke it out, of course, verbally, rhetorically.